Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. And with a little bit of egg on my face, I have to admit that I got our schedule for this hour wrong. I thought Hillary and Chelsea Clinton were our first guests after the news this hour. They are our second guests after the news this hour. So Hillary and Chelsea Clinton coming up after we talk about District 16 in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn, which has a problem. Year after year, its schools are losing kids, even as parents vie for spots at a community school down the street. This is the problem that the new podcast, School Colors from Brooklyn Deep, starts with, and its search for answers exposes the forces that shape New York City's public school system, not just in Bed-Stuy. Race, class, power, policies like school choice, and mayoral control. In the studio with me now to discuss what's happening in Bed-Stuy and beyond are the co-host and co-producers of the podcast, journalist Max Friedman and Mark Winston Griffith, executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center. Max, welcome to WNYC, and Mark, welcome back.
Hi, great
Thanks
to
for
be
having
here.
Us.
Let's go into some history first that you cover in the series, and some of our older listeners may remember this moment in New York City history when there was conflict around the schools in the Ocean Hill, Brownsville section of Brooklyn in the late 1960s. And local parents went head-to-head with the teachers union over control of the schools, resulting in the longest ever teacher strike in America in the fall of 1968, around the beginning of the school year then. There's a fascinating moment where you talk about how both of you had family members who were involved, but on opposite sides. So can we start there, Max? What's your connection to the 1968 teacher strike?
So my grandfather grew up in Brownsville. His parents were immigrants from what's now Ukraine. And
at least until Russia takes it over next week, but never mind.
It's another episode.
Yeah.
That's right. It's another show.
So my branch of the family was already in California, in Southern California by this point, but I have a cousin, my mom's first cousin, who was a young union teacher in 1968, teaching in Brownsville. And when the strike broke out, he was on the picket lines in front of Junior High School 271 almost every day.
And what was the issue, according to how your family member saw it?
Well, the union framed this, at least at first, as an issue simply of due process. There were a number of teachers and supervisors who had been let go or transferred or fired, depending on who you ask, by the community-controlled school board in Ocean Hill, Brownsville. The union said that they had not been given their due process, and so they went on strike citywide. As the strike went on, their messaging around that changed. Our take on it is that the due process argument was simply not working and capturing the attention of the city when they, you know, a million kids were having to stay home from school every day. But certainly when I asked my cousin about it, he said it was just about due process for teachers. That was it.
And Mark, what's your family connection to the 1968 teacher strike?
Well, I think it begins from the late 40s and early 50s when my family moved to Central Brooklyn. But more directly, my uncle, my father, and a lot of my extended family all worked for the department, well, the Board of Education at that time, and they were teachers. They were black teachers, black educators, and very self-consciously so. My uncle, that is my father's brother, was at some point the second in command, if you will, of the Afro-American Teachers Association. And so during the strike, they were all based in schools in Brooklyn, and they were sort of forced to, you know, to make a decision about what side of the line they were going to be on. And I think that, well, not I think, I know they ultimately identified with the cause of community control and identified as black folks who were struggling for self-determination in Central Brooklyn.
And on the podcast, you say Ocean Hill, Brownsville is, quote, like a Rosetta Stone for understanding the New York City school system today. So,
right.
Mark, what's the line from the teacher strike of 1968 to the fall of 2019?
Well, you know, this is a theme throughout the podcast because, yes, we go to 1968, but actually we go, you know, 100 years before then as well, and see how these issues that we're tackling now or sort of gripping the city in terms of race and class and how people exert themselves on a personal level, on the neighborhood level, all these themes have existed for a long time. And if you look at Ocean Hill-Brownsville, you will see the seeds in many ways of a lot of the issues that are coming up, coming out now. So when we talk about, for instance, the diversity plan that we're talking about here in New York City, so many of these issues in terms of, you know, people's identification with neighborhoods and, you know, how do they get the best education for their children and how the city is segregated in many ways and punishes people who are of color and low and moderate income, all those things were being discussed and debated and really fought over in Ocean Hill-Brownsville in 1968.
And Max, over the course of the podcast series, you track the history of community control to mayoral control. Can you talk about the difference? Because there certainly has been a pendulum, right? And if you look at the issue in that 1968 teacher strike from the community perspective, they wanted local control. And they thought that would be good, especially for the kids of color who were not being served by the centralized white establishment. By the time you get to Mayor Bloomberg, the local districts, the 32 local school districts that the city had been divided up into, were seen as, in too many cases, either corrupt or ineffective. And so, you know, the next Holy Grail was get Albany to give us mayoral control so somebody would really be accountable and it would be the mayor of New York City. So in the 60s, local control was seen as, you know, purity and the path to better education. And by the 2000s, it was seen as mayoral control. That's quite a pendulum swing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think it would be easy to say that after the community control movement, when we got these local school boards in 1969, that community control advocates got what they were fighting for. And in many ways, they didn't. They did set the city, the state set up these local school boards, but they set up 30, 31, and then 32 of them, and people had been advocating for 60 to 64 of them, which would have been much smaller, much more local. And we're talking about local accountability. The school boards that we had for 30 years were not in many ways very locally accountable, even though that's what they were supposed to be. And so instead of making the school boards more locally accountable, making them smaller, putting more mechanisms in place so that they would be really be responsive to the wishes of the community, we just got rid of it completely. Which I understand. I think the system was really in a bad state at a certain point, and there's a really human temptation to say this is a mess. Let's bring in a singular figure who can kind of clean it all up. But there were still, even at that time, a lot of people who were saying, no, we need more. It needs to be more local, more accountable to the parents in the district, and we need more of a stronger democratic culture in general in New York City. But that was not really there to support.
Do you want to add to that?
Yeah, Mark? I do, because what we talk about in the podcast is, you know, the development of this narrative. That is, the community control and what came after decentralization was used to make this argument that black and brown folks and low and moderate income folks, look, we gave them a chance to get their stuff together. To shape their own schools and destinies, and they just couldn't do it. They don't have the wherewithal to do it, and so we need a strong central figure to shape these forces. And so I think that has a big impact on the development, not only the education system, but on the city in general. And it has really stripped this idea of parent power and the fact that local people are driving decisions. And that, so when you talk about the pendulum swing, mm-hmm. that's where we are today. Mm-hmm. This idea that we should not concentrate power locally.
And some listeners are calling in, and we can take a few calls on the 1968 teacher strike and the issues in Brooklyn that sparked it. but also, listeners, you can call and talk about the contemporary issues that this all feeds into, which is, of course, the central concern, what happens now, of our guests, journalist Max Friedman and activist Mark Winston Griffith, executive director of the Brooklyn Movement Center, who have a new podcast together called School Colors from Brooklyn Deep. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9673. 9-2. All right, you ready to hear a 51-year-old memory? David in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, David.
Hi, I'm in my 70s, actually. I taught at 271 for 10 years after the strike. And I have to tell you that the kids did not get a proper education. I have a social studies license, but I could not use it because my sixth graders could not read a book. So I ended up being a reading teacher for 9 years, and it just was, the principal seemed more concerned with how the students were dressed, and discipline was very strictly enforced. We had a conduct sheet, which was passed around from one class to the next when the bell rang. Open school night, one parent shows up, so how are you going to get community involvement if parents have so many personal issues that they're dealing with that they can't come into school to find out how the students are doing?
David, with your experience, is there one central reform then after 45 years, or a few that you can state briefly that you think would help kids like you used to teach?
Well, I had three paraprofessionals who were almost twice my age, but there were other problems, personality problems between the parents. A more direct effect would be integration, number one, and get better teachers. The staff we had math teachers who couldn't even multiply fractions at it, give them tutorials privately on Fridays. They were so embarrassed that they could not teach the basic mathematics to their students. So I'm trying to figure out, why can't we get better staffing? Why isn't the school more integrated? I started a track team of my own, and which was rather successful, and we just couldn't get parents involved in the community.
David, thank you so much for your memory. I really appreciate it. Max, what are you thinking as you listen to that?
I'm very sad, honestly. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about how the defeat of community control, you know, this community was, in Ocean Hill-Brownsville, was mobilized to an extent that's hard to even picture today around the issue of community control, because I think there was an understanding that it was really interlinked. The schools are really interlinked with housing and healthcare and all these things that were so necessary to make this community thrive. And with the defeat of the experiment at the end of the teacher's strike with the decentralization law, which dismantled the district and the experimental district, people were really discouraged. And over the course of the next 30 years, these communities were even further disinvested from. It became even harder just to live. Federal disinvestment and various things, And so, yeah, it of course is a problem that parents have so much going on that it's hard for them to come and get involved in the school. And so we have to think not only about what do we set up to give parents the ability to be a part of school governance, but also how do we invest in these communities so that parents are not struggling to the point where that seems like something that's not possible.
Mark, want to keep going on that?
Yeah. So first of all, thank you, David, for those reflections. And what you said, you know, mirrors what other people have said during that time. But it also is in contradiction to what we have heard from some of the children who were there as well. We talked to at least three or four students who were there at the time, some of whom say that the education they received there was the best that they had ever received. But what's important to do, when we go into the episode, we really break it down. And you have to understand that, you know, the experiment community control was very limited, was very short period of time. And we talk about kids not being able to read and write. Well, you know, that's how they got there. And the struggle for community control was a reaction to how the segregated system had really deformed their educational experience. And the struggle for community control was really, in some ways, a desperate attempt to, you know, to make themselves human through the education system. And so even in that brief experimental year, most of the time, these children and everyone around them were under duress. They were walking, you know, there were dogs and police officers outside. There were picket lines. And so the sad part about it is the experiment was never really allowed to thrive or even function to some extent.
So coming closer to the present, the school district for about half of Bed-Stuy, District 16, is at the heart of a lot of the conversations that you have in the podcast about race, power, and education. And in the first episode, you hear from parents and kids who are fighting to keep one of the schools in District 16, PS 25, open, even though it only had 82 students last year. It can fit almost 1,000.
Right.
So, Mark, how did it get to this point, and how do you see the issue for that school and in citywide terms?
Well, how we got to that point is the the subject of a lot of the podcast.
Yeah.
I mean, it's 8 episodes, and we spend an entire episode on PS25, and we don't come up with any conclusive answers, but we explore different threads. And so there's the demographics of the neighborhood and the impacts of gentrification, and the fact that, you know, this school in particular was just sort of ignored, to some extent was forgotten by a lot of people, and was also competing with a charter school that was working in the same building. That and just a series of other things just kind of conspired on the school, and it really begged the question, you know, do we keep this school open? Do we want to honor sort of our values of keeping schools open and having small class sizes, or is this really just something, a fruit in the system that's dying and that we just need to get rid of? And so it opens up a whole series of questions about what we're trying to do in our districts.
Yvette in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Yvette.
Hi, I'm just calling, and I love your show, Brian.
Thank you. I'm calling
because why are we ignoring the fact that this is all systematic bullcrap? I'm tired of this. Our black children are the smartest kids ever if they're given a fair chance. I'm tired of the chancellor wanting them to get all this help for these tests. They don't need help. They just need the same chances that these white counterparts get. I'm sick of this. Asian kids, I've been seeing it when I was in college. Asian kids cheating on tests, but they getting what they get because they're Asian and they think they smart, but half of them are not. And the same thing with Caucasians. They help the Caucasian kids a lot, and they never help our African-American kids. I'll say black because I love saying black. Black and Hispanic kids, those Hispanic kids came here from other countries and learned this language. So you're going to tell me they're not smart enough to catch up to where these kids are? Y'all not being fair. It's about the resources never being in these areas. Y'all take them out because the kids are achieving, because y'all afraid of the competition that we're going to have. That's it. I'm tired of everybody keep putting a blanket over what's real. Systematic racism. Caucasians get too much help, and black people get too much thing taken away from them, so they can't keep up. And that's it. I'm very upset with this piece, because I'm tired of us black people catering to this stuff, too. Say what's real. They're not giving our kids a fair chance, and that's it. And when they did give us a fair chance, we surpassed them, and that's why y'all worried. And that's what I have to say. Look at this.
Thank you very much. Mark Winston Griffith.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think if she listens to the podcast, I think that she'll appreciate how we deconstruct, the impact of racism and racial exclusion on black children and black families, you know, over the years. So I don't think you'd ever come up with anything other than that understanding.
Right.
If you listen.
And I think you would agree with the two main points, if I can characterize them this way, of her phone call, systemic racism, and
right,
that a central expression of that is not the same resources going to, black and brown families,
right,
particularly in neighborhoods with a lot of poverty.
Right. It's 8 episodes chronicling just that. Black folks really trying to make sure that they get the same resources and same opportunities. And, you know, most of the time coming up short trying to do that.
Max?
Well, it's making me think about a story in episode 4 where we talked to Dr. Lester Young, who's now on the State Board of Regents, but was in the 80s an assistant commissioner for education for the state. And he remembers going to a meeting with the commissioner, the state commissioner at the time, and the state commissioner is talking about how we need to redistribute resources and talent in the state of New York to historically disadvantaged communities, to black and brown communities. And one of the regents at the time says, I understand what you're saying, but I can't go back to my community,
right,
unless my box is bigger than theirs. And I think the question is who has the ability to say something like that and make it happen?
Yeah. So how much are resources the issue? because there's so much focus right now on desegregation and blaming Mayor de Blasio for not focusing on desegregation until Richard Carranza came in as chancellor. But some people say it's really about the money. If you put a lot of black kids in classes that currently have a lot of white kids and vice versa, that doesn't mean that the black kids are going to get an appropriate education necessarily. If still the, because the system is still, what is it, 80% non-white? And so it's not going to be equal distribution around the city. You're still going to have very weighted districts by different ethnic groups. And so the issue is really like dollars per kid, dollars per school, resources in various ways.
I mean,
true or false?
Well, I mean, obviously resources are a huge part of it. But I think that what we try to do through the podcast is talk about how much more complicated it is. I mean, not just, excuse me, as journalists and as organizers, but really I'm a parent. I have two children. They have struggled. You know, I have struggled as a parent as far as public school, traditional publics, charters, privates. I've been through them all. And as a black middle class parent, what struck me was really how the system was designed to center and sort of reward white middle class families. And, I mean, I was able to see that very clearly. And so, yes, we're talking about resources, but it's also about social capital. It's about connections. It's about, again, what happens in segregated places and just perception. You know, just the fact that there's a black school and there's a white school and they've got all the same sort of reading scores, it's going to be assumed that the black school is inferior. And when you ever hear people talk about good schools and bad schools, there's all sorts of racial and class coding that goes on in there. And so you can't strip that out of the equation.
We're going to run out of time in a couple of minutes, and we have Hillary Rodham Clinton and Chelsea Clinton standing by, who are going to be on together as our next guests. But Mark, how's de Blasio doing? I mean, he came in saying,
"Wow, that, I hadn't expected that one." Go ahead.
Well, I mean, in your opinion,
terms of education.
Oh, yes, of course. And only that, or you can say anything else about him that you want. You know, are his workouts at the gym making him more fit? I don't know. But the seriously, you know, he came in with a rejection of the Bloomberg school choice and close schools deemed failing and reopen them as something different model. How's de Blasio doing?
Well, I do appreciate the fact that he tried to pivot away from where Bloomberg was going. I think that if I was giving him a report card, I'd give him, I don't know, B minus maybe. I feel like he's got people in his administration who care about communities and parent power and are really trying to institutionalize those things. But, you know, this is a really tough system to turn around. And I think, you know, we see him struggling with that right now. But I feel like his values as far as education are concerned are roughly in the right place.
Max, how can people sign up for this podcast?
You can find School Colors on any podcast app, including Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and all that stuff. And you can go to schoolcolorspodcast.com. And if you've been listening to School Colors, I want to tell you, you can come to the Brooklyn Movement Center actually tonight at 6:30 to talk to us about it. So we'll be talking about episodes 1 through 4 tonight at the Brooklyn Movement Center, and childcare will be provided if you're a parent.
That's the Brooklyn Movement Center, 375 Stuyvesant Avenue in Bed-Stuy, to discuss the first four episodes of the podcast. And there's a phrase we don't hear very much when people are promoting events: child care will be provided. Mm-hmm. So that's 6:30 this evening at the Brooklyn Movement Center. Mark and Max, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.